Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. My guests today are members of one of Australia's biggest bands. They've slowly but surely mounted their musical assault on this hemisphere with the help of two stellar records, 2015's The Positions and 2017's Go Farther in Lightness. Their latest album, Angel in Real Time, is the result of nearly 5 years of intense workshopping, numerous false starts, a serious case of writer's block, and one immense personal loss. It's a monument to frontman Dave Leopepe's late father, who died of cancer in 2018. The song cycle finds him coming to terms with the life milestone and contemplating the loneliness of his passing, juxtaposed with the comfort and peace that often comes when a loved one transcends this reality and into another. To paraphrase the group's own description, Angel in Real Time is a meditation on the meaning of death, grief, and God, and also a nod to the London neighborhood of Angel that served as the band's home base. It's also a celebration of Dave's own Samoan heritage. The record is packed with references and recordings of indigenous music of the South Pacific, in addition to sounds of modern classical, English drum and bass, and American folk. Angel in Real Time is a highly ambitious work of creative and personal growth, and it was well worth the wait. I'm so happy to welcome Dave Leopepe and Max Dunn of Gang of Youths. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Just to kick it off, I mean, I just want to offer you guys a well-deserved congratulations and thank you for Angel in Real Time. I mean, I know you've been working on it for several years now, and I think I'm right in saying you recorded it three different versions of it. I mean, how did you know it was done? How did you know you had it where you wanted it finally?
It was done when the label said, all right, dickhead.
Major label deadline. That's the honest answer.
So you're first for Warner's, right? Yeah. So
yeah. It's weird. Like, our experience with major labels is kind of more synonymous with how they experienced it probably in the 90s when they had oodles of money and credit cards for like cartel wrought cocaine. like that kind of thing. Like, but they've been really permissive with us and really even-tempered and cool with us, you know, which is, you know, not the stereotype of most major labels. And honestly, we stay out of their business, they stay out of ours. The Warner team here in the UK are unbelievable. The American team are really, really, really great, super supportive, they're unbelievable as well. So it's been kind of like that, but they were like, listen, it's been 2 fucking years, stop pissing around, get it done. So that's kind of what we had to know. And I think there was this
and our wives as well.
Yeah, and our wives, yeah, because Max had a kid and, you know, it's the whole thing. But I think it was just a tacit understanding that we had said everything that we wanted to say in the best way possible, and it was beautiful. We all found it beautiful. We keep fucking using this word today, don't we, Moxie? It's this idea of something that felt beautiful. And I was saying before, and I'll say it now, this is the first time in my career I felt that I don't absolutely hate something, just hate it a little bit. This is a fucking miracle for me. But Mox likes it.
I think it's stunning, man. Like, I think, you know, because we made so much bad shit. Well, not even bad, but just non-right shit that it really does feel like really cool. And it was like so free, and it was fucking hard. Like, obviously, we were going insane at certain points of like 2 years during lockdown in a room. But I just mean it was everything that, you know, Dave's probably wanted in terms of influences in the past that had been too weird or too like whatever. And, you know, we were able to throw ourselves into that and all our different backgrounds and kind of just come up with something really beautiful and weird, and like that felt like it was the right thing for who we are now, which is really cool. Yeah. I feel like Dave feels
you don't, better. Yeah. You only know when you've arrived, when you arrive. Like, it was sort of, you just got there and it got to the last track being done, kind of the scaffolding of it. And I think we just kind of paused and said, I think we're about nearly there. All we need is some lyrics.
I get lyrics.
And it was interesting because, like, at the outset of the whole fucking album, right, when I first started working on 2017, I knew it would be a total pain to get done. It would be a lot of late nights, a lot of travel, a lot of money spent to get the sound that we wanted, the size of the string ensemble that we wanted, you know, to pay the musicians correctly, to appropriately distribute royalties to the rights holders of not only the recordings of the samples that we've used by David Fanshawe, but also the people who performed that, trying to find ways. So we understood there would be a lot that went into it. So I think once that stuff was kind of ironed out, and we got a sense of what the album was going to sound like mix-wise, because we actually started mixing some of these songs before vocals were even on it, because I hadn't finished the lyrics for some things. Some things had lyrics for eons and decades, and other things just took a really long time. So it was basically when the lyrics were done, okay, the album's done. Do you know what I mean? Our mate Count mixed it, and also Peter Kadis, who we can't forget, who was just fucking amazing. He mixed Returner and Unison, but like, people really, really worked against the clock on it. So the way I then, especially Count, who did so much work, massive, massive, massive gratitude. Yeah, huge debt.
On the tracks where you had the instrumental arrangements done but working on the lyrics, did you know what you wanted to say in those songs? Was it a case of sitting down and working out how to articulate it? Or did you sit with the instrumental tracks and just think, where does this take me right now? What is it that this music makes me feel?
That's a good question. It was column A and column B. I always have a title of a song before I have lyrics. And the title is just the placeholder that sparks some emotion related to the song for me, or a concept or feeling. For the most part, man, it kind of works in different ways depending on the song. It always starts with a melody for me, weirdly. On this one, it was all melodic, and finding phrasing and words that fit that, and then a mood to fit the phrasing and words, and then trying to carve out a shape of or a contour of the themes or whatever. I'm not someone who just kind of could just put out words. There's always a central nervous system, like a centrifugal motion that exists at the nucleus of every song or whatever that propels it, that gives it meaning and value to me, that make me not want to fucking die every time we have to perform the motherfucker. Do you know what I mean? So finding that meaning was the hard basket. Do you know what I mean? And for some songs like The Kingdom Is Within You or You and Everything, the meaning, the approach, many of the lyrics, they're kind of already there. or I had a tacit understanding of where that song was going to go. Whereas like with Forbearance, I had an inkling of what I wanted the song to sound like, but kind of changed and shifted, and then it went back around to being what it was about. Does that make sense? So it just kind of depends on what song. And I think Forbearance always had a strong melodic component that tied me to emotions around that, that were kind of like, you know, synonymous with those melodies. It kind of just fed itself, I think. You know, but that was a completed instrumental fucking almost a year ago, which is wild.
Wow. Yeah. I think I read, and I don't know, maybe I misunderstood this, that the project began with the album's title. Did that, well, I guess, question one, is that true? And question two, how did that kind of serve as sort of the, you know, your lodestar, your you know, your guide throughout this?
I mean, Max, you remember this, but I actually started working on this album in 2017, where we was living, we just moved to London. I started working on the album.
St. Peter Street. Yeah. Jordan lived in Islington, Dave.
So he, oh, like, did you, mate?
Right on Pentonville and Caledonian.
Oh, so that makes you an asshole, then. We can forgive you for that. So, Pentonville and Caledonian, so that was right near where we were, mate. Like, I can't even express to you how meaningful that neighbourhood is, because we used to live in Holloway on Caledonian Road. What was our street? Corporation Street. Just near Cali Road Station. So that was actually where I wrote The Angel of Eighth Avenue. Is where I started working on, like what turned into Unison, Tend the Garden, a little bits are in there. There's just a lot of stuff I started working on there, and I kind of had this vision of, like, because I knew my dad wasn't well and he was sick. I knew that one day I'd have to confront the realities of my heritage and his upbringing, and I was like thinking about integrating some of that stuff, but I knew I wanted to use samples. Do you know what I mean? And so I feel like that was the genesis of where it started. Angel Real Time, however, tied everything into a cohesive whole for me. And I came up with that album name in 2018, Maxi. I was walking around Angel the day that we found the house that we all lived in. And
that's always how it's been with you. Like every album we've ever made, there's a name before. I remember being told, like, oh, we should make Godfather and Lightness now. And being like, okay, like, whatever the fuck that means, you know, at the time. which is a cool trait, man. It's like, it's cool to have, like, a North Star as, like, a dude in a band. Like, it's, well, yeah.
It's weird because I always think of, like, this is going to sound like the most fucking pretentious bullshit ever, but Thomas Pynchon in Gravity's Rainbow, there's that thing about, you never did the Kenosha Kid, and there's like 6,000 different. And I used to follow a Twitter account years ago that produces different grammatical variations of "You never did the Kenosha Kid." Now, if the people haven't read Gravity's Rainbow, I don't want to fucking ruin it, but it's just like it's for me the fluidity of that sentence is explored a lot, and not in the book, but in the fandom surrounding that. Hence why there's an auto-generated Twitter that generates like new grammatical variations. But just this, a simple nonsensical statement can have a lot of thematic weight depending on its interpretation. And I like that there's like, almost use the term post-structuralist. What am I, fucking professor in Boston at Harvard? Right. What am I, a fucking white collar professional? No, there's a sense of like each word denoting something else. And so I thought Angel in Real Time. We live in Angel. My dad's an angel. Real time. You know, I just, all these kind of images are conjured up over this kind of relatively benign sort of phrase. And I loved how it's open interpretation to me, but to others, but it meant something to me. So with Go Father and Lightness. What the fuck is Go Farther? Why that word? Why not further? Why Lightness? What the fuck is Lightness? You know, I like the idea of the English language being poised for interpretation always at any given time, and a collection of a few, like the positions. I mean, I was using it as a reference to Leonard Cohen's various positions, but it could also mean the positions on a football pitch or stuff. You know, I think there's so much fluidity. So if I just come up with words that sound beautiful and they suggest something, they imply meaning, then perhaps fucking potentially something will come from it. Like, there will be blood. You know what I mean? Chunking Express. Do you know what I'm saying? I like the ideas that so much of...
Almost like Lewis Carroll.
Yeah, I know. It's all whimsy and bullshit, but to me, it makes some fucking conceptual sense. but that's how I start everything. I feel like a title is cinematic, and it helps me derive meaning and shape an arc without having to do too much like groundwork. You know, it's all about the big picture type stuff in the initial stages of planning a record.
How do you feel about it? I feel like there's sort of two schools of thought with artists being asked about their lyrics. There are some who will dive right in and almost treat it like a diary and tell you, you know, what they were feeling, where these came from. And then there are others who are, you know, prefer to be a little more vague and really want to leave it open to interpretation and open to, you know, people to bring their own twist to it. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about discussing your words?
I trust people to not treat my fucking words as gospel, because that would be stupid if you treat anything that anybody in the public eye said is totally fucking gospel. That would be absurd, right? So I ask the people, it's my shit. I'll say what I want about it. I respect people who fucking don't. Just straight up, you know, I was watching this thing with Trent Reznor, who I like a lot. He doesn't like to talk about meaning in songs. He even said that it ruins it. I'm sorry, Trent. I like ruining stuff. I was saying, I know Swiftie doesn't like to mention stuff, and she's obviously very talented, good at her job. But I like to. I enjoy ruining it for people. I think it's important to understand context. I'm a fucking layman student of history, and I have a very intense desire to keep reliving my connection to place and time. Mm. And so in order for me to do that, I do that through the medium of very mediocre indie rock music. And so the way – do you understand what I mean? So these are the ways that I like to approach the world and how I want to approach art. And I think people who want to leave it up to interpretation, that's cool. I think there's pretentiousness on my side, because I feel like it's so what I have to say is so important and so meticulous that I have to share it with it. And I do understand there's probably criticism. But I would say naturally people who want to keep it to themselves, I'm not a big believer in this mystique and this mystical, spiritualized, great band, by the way, spiritualized fucking... what's the word? Hocus pocus around lyrics. Do you know what I mean? They're not going to save the world. It's poetry, and it can be like anything is up to interpretation, even if I tell you the truth of what it means. So I think that debate doesn't really rage in my head, because I just don't care. It's not really part of what consumes my thought. Do you know what I mean? I'm more concerned with whether I'm communicating what I want to say effectively enough, not whether or not does that make sense, Jordan? I feel like it might be a pretty harsh answer to a really reasonable question. But.
No, not at all. I mean, I in a lot of ways, I feel like you're being, you're taking self-deprecation to the level of a martial art, I should say.
We were just talking about this in another interview, man. I've just been drawn, it's come to my attention so often now, I'm starting to fucking think that if I ever do another interview again, I'm going to have to be this cocky, cocksure, fucking self-assured kind of bloke. You know, so next time I speak to you, you'll be like, have you been smoking some really great shit?
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said, my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia, starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I hadn't planned on sharing this, but I guess just in the interest of what you just said, when I was a young boy, I lost a parent, and this was more than 20 years ago. And just recently over Christmas.
I'm so sorry to hear that, mate.
Oh, no, no. I mean,
dude, I'm sorry, well, man. Sorry, just, shit.
No. Just recently over Christmas, a distant family member that I hadn't known got in touch with me and sent me a tremendous gift, a box of all sorts of teenage letters and diaries my mom had written and photos and stuff. And it kind of made me think of what you were writing on this album too, because I do.
How old were you when that happened? I'm sorry to hear that, man.
Oh, no. I was
favorite people in the world lost her mum. One of my favorite people ever lost her mum when she was a little girl. So I feel really, strongly, I feel really strongly for you, man.
Oh no, thank you. I mean, I was 12 and I'm 34 now. I listening to your songs and the words that you were saying, and even just, this sounds corny, but even between the lines of the lyrics too, it hit me in a personal way. Because I sort of know on a certain level what you were singing about, sort of getting to know your parent after the fact. And, I mean, what's that ancient Egyptian expression? Something like, to speak a man's name is to restore him to eternal life, which to any...
I've never heard that, but that is beautiful.
I think
fucking ancient Egyptians. Top.
I think I stole that from a Doors interview, by the way. So for anyone who thinks I'm actually well read, I'm not. I definitely took that from Jim Morrison. But just the journey that you went through on this record, it connected with me, even in ways that maybe you don't realize, and I'm sure with so many people too. I mean, at what point? And this question's to both of you. Do you start thinking of the audience when you're putting songs together?
I mean, all these songs are fragments of a grief eternal, right? It doesn't ever leave you. And I think there's a sense of this. I think there's a sense of disconnectedness I'll always have with an audience purely because my job, our job, is to craft things that people consume. I say this in every fucking interview, but being a musician is a trade. You ply your trade. We're overpaid assholes, most of us. We're who do something rather. It's a profession that otherwise wouldn't have inspired, the kind of fandom that we see in the 20th and 21st century. Maybe the 17th and 18th, it might have been, the 19th might have been a thing with some Baroque composers. But we're fortunate that our craft is market speaking, considered to be worth more than it actually is. I think what I'm trying, like, Max, you were going to interrupt me with something self-effacing before I go in for the kill with something like pejorative. So maybe you go.
No, I was just going to say, like, the entire thing is like, I mean, for me, music is just about making people, feel you know, like, you know, like, I don't know, like the umami of the song.
Umami.
Like the fucking, like, that's the job, man. Like the whole thing is like, do I listen to this when I'm listening to the mix, and am I like massively affected by it? Is it beautiful? Is it bringing out the beauty or like the meaning in the lyrics by accident or in good ways? Is there contrast? Whatever.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to gesture at. Look, it's just the job, and you can't help but think about where your table goes if you've made a table. You can't help but think about like.
That's an incredible, yeah.
But, oh, I wonder what this thing that I spent fucking 6.5 hours or 6.5 weeks, 6.5 years making, I wonder where this is going to go. How the fuck are you supposed to not? So for me, it's like, if I'm making ergonomic chairs in my basement, you know, you want to make sure that people are fucking enjoying sitting their ass on them, you know? Even if aesthetically they're not as pleasing as you, the shit you might get down at the fucking... You know, the IKEA.
Self-deprecation is killing me, man.
No, but it's not. I think there's something more reminiscent of the way that I grew up and the way they look at music, that it's a job, it's a profession, and you want to think about where it goes. And any bit of handiwork that you do is a small mark on planet Earth. You know, even the smallest piece of literature or fucking, and that's nice to think about. It's meaningless and it's bullshit, but it's still in some way lovely. You know, and I would like anything that I have to be reminiscent and reflective of the talent that surrounds me and the four other guys in the band, and also to reach people if they choose to be reached. You know, that's an important thing, but it's hard to balance because I'm such a fucking people pleaser, right? That if I think about what the peanut gallery wants, then they get nothing but peanuts. You know, and I'm like. And they'll never change. They'll never change to something more nutritious, like pears. You know what I mean? So I just have to be realistic about how much of myself I can give away to that thought. You know, because I'm prone to it. You know, I'm a total as Joyce Meyer. You know who Joyce Meyer is? Joyce Meyer. She's like this Christian author preacher.
Shout out, bro.
No. I've never read any of her shit. Bro.
How many jets does she have, Dan?
A fucking bunch of jets, loads of jets. Bro, she's a jet happy,
preacher. Your jet, mate.
But there's this thing called approval addicts that she talks about that I vaguely remember while drunk at a Hillsong conference when I was fucking 15. That was something like being such an approval addict. I have to balance how much I think about how this will be received. For me, it's not necessarily like people because people will like or dislike it. It's more like. I think growing up, I was really overly, what's the word? Overly, overly like reverent to critical appraisal of my work, not realizing that critics are also people who have their own feelings, thoughts, biases, and they come and go with the times as well. And it was also doing a disservice to the role of the music critic and a music writer I treated them as, you know, somehow different, which I don't think they would appreciate because I think it's an important role in culture to be a writer or a critic or someone who appraises things. I think that there is some importance there. But that was like a struggle that I had for fucking years, you know. All I wanted was them fucking 5 stars, 10 out of 10, all that bullshit. And it's not bullshit when it matters, but I think when I think about that, that's when I lose my way a little bit. Do you know what I mean? And I think most critics that I know and that I'm tight with don't place a massive emphasis on their job as being the be-all and end-all, but they see it as part of an unfolding conversation. And for me, instead of being terrified of that conversation, I just sort of let it go. And just I'm happy to allow it to continue on. And I think that's been the biggest change in me is like, the sense that any kind of approval outside of what goes on in here and what goes on in the room with those four other guys, here being myself, my soul, and what goes on in the room with four other guys, that's possibly more important. Not much more, but, you know, that's kind of where I need to gauge, you know. And you know, there's, I think that, I think it's not about drowning out noise, because I don't necessarily believe, for example, that constructive criticism or engagement or, you know, discussion is bad. I think it's actually really good. It's more about just choosing how and when I allow that stuff into my orbit. Does that make sense? And that affects my relationship with the music more than anything. Or at least it used to. And, you know, now having known many people in music writing and you know, I've realized how completely immature and wrong I was to fetishize it. So, do you know what I mean?
What did success look like to you when you were first starting out as a band? Hearing you say all this, now I'm curious.
Mate, enough money for cigs.
Hey, I mean, yeah.
Like chucking a sickie from work and then not having to worry about like whether or not I go back. Now, what's yours, mate?
I think yours are more complicated. Your answer. Mine was kind of just, oh shit, like, here's an opportunity to be in an actual band that does this and tours and see a fair bit of the Western world, not as much of the rest of it as we want, but, you know, see a fair bit of all that, play some fucking rad venues. I wanted to take it as far as I could, to be honest. I really believed in it. I still do. That's why I'm doing it.
There's an awful lot of past tense in there, Maxi Boy.
No, but I do think.
I
still have that, like that ambition, but I do think, yeah, you kind of, when I talk about like people being the gig, like I'm not sort of saying it and, make everyone like it, or certainly not make critics like it. Even though it's cool when they do, it's more about like, the ideal is like creating something beautiful that really affects us and I think inspires us. Like I don't think Gang of Youths has ever tried, is sort of ever made an album that, you know, at the time we didn't feel some sense. I mean, Dave might say so, but I certainly at the time always felt like we were doing something really fucking special, and I really loved the songs and I loved performing them, and I still do, you know? So for me, it's like, yeah, I'm like, it's a weird, it's like a mature ambition now. You know, when you're like 20, it's like, if we're not doing Madison Square Garden in 2 years, then like the world's fucked. And then you realize like, oh, wow, like, you're 5 years in and you're like, I just drove 15 hours to like play to 10 people in Salt Lake City or something. And you're like, fuck, man, like,
you are not,
you have Maxie, to have a why not, that's bigger than Maxie, that shit, you know?
Maxie, you have not lived until you played Kilby Court. I loved that show. That was one of my fucking favorite moments.
Kilby Court, man. That was awesome.
Mate, I loved it. I loved it. I fucking loved it with their irony. And it, like, some just the sweetest people turned out. And it's safe to assume that a couple of them are Mormons and they didn't drink.
I think Kilby we played just seven people.
It was one of my favorite. It was one of my favorite times. Like, for me, right, like, the idea of success is purely like, do I have enough money to keep fucking lights on, to give my wife a bed to sleep in, and my dog enough medicine? Like, that's the success thing. All the other stuff is cool. But playing Kilby Court felt so surreal. For me, it's engaging these totally surreal environments now. Like, things that help me appreciate people for who they are when they come to the show. Seven fucking people, no booze, in a shed.
Our tour manager, like, didn't watch the show. That's my
tour manager. Yeah, like, he sat and just watched. He watched the NBA playoffs. He's like, fuck this. He's amazing.
It was the LeBron 3-1. Yeah, fuck, that was awesome. Yeah.
But we was playing, and I reckon that most people stay home and watch the game. But that's like a good picture for me of what success looks like. It's just having enough in my world to be able to do that, you know. But that would be the same with any job. I don't necessarily attach too much financial motivation or too much personal motivation to my job, because it's a vocation. And whether, like, I could just as easily not have had a break as a lead singer. Do you know what I mean? I could be still on unemployment. You know, I could still, like, what we do is completely lucky. So tying it in with some level of some kind of abstraction like success doesn't really make sense to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're not the one if you're in a band. You know what I mean? Like, you're not fucking Neo. Like,
yeah, you're not like shit up. You're not like it looks like a chosen fucking person. But it's so weird that we have a perception that as soon as you're in a band, you're a total bastion of moral superiority and cleanliness, and everything about you's fucking like spot on, and you have all the right opinions and shit. Like, fucking. Well, like we was kids, we were kids, right? You know, I was like barely fucking 19, 18 or something, which now seems that you're supposed to be so grown up by that point. I fucking wasn't. So you go into these things with kind of low expectations, but big dreams and aspirations. You try to achieve them. You're not a fully formed person at all. And I think that was what, that's kind of how I would. What do you reckon, Max? Back me up.
There's been a lot of we're a band that's had a lot of we're a very lucky band. Like I said, there's people better than us who aren't doing this, you know. But there's definitely been times where like we've been it's felt like we're that close to being like the fucking killers or something, or usually because someone's saying bullshit to you. You know, I'm not saying recently. I'm saying over the years. And then and then it's just like you just get absolutely fucked. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh, we've barely made it. You know, like, we've done it. And then it's just like, and then like the next 6 months, you're just like sleeping on floors or something. I love that about music. It's like such a, you have to have something beyond it that's like not obsessing about the success or you just go nuts.
You're like a shark and you just die if it's not swimming. We had like a number five album in Australia at some point, and I was sleeping on someone's office floor, off a bed on someone's office. Do you know what I mean? Like I had like the way that you relate to, because in Australia, like we had no idea we'd blown up until we'd moved. Like I'm fucking not shitting you. Like we weren't like a big band. We were a touring band, but like we weren't like, you know, we weren't this we weren't what we are now. We weren't even close to it. Well, I had no fucking clue. Then we go back to Australia and doing all these shows and we're playing these fucking huge. That was really how it was. We did some stuff. We played some festival slots, but they were all during the day. Like we didn't have the same vibe. You know, I mean, we just thought we were another middling kind of indie rock band amidst a sea of decent ones. You know, man. And so when that one, so when that whole perception changes, it only happens after the fact. And by this time, like, gone back to Australia, my poor wife, who had literally no fucking clue about how successful we'd become in Australia, because I fucking barely knew. I didn't fucking know that. She comes and then you witness it. It's like, oh, I see. Okay, well, wild.
Yeah. Was that gratifying for you? Was that terrifying for you? Was that confusing for you?
Not particularly, because I think we left Australia because the groundswell of fame and bullshit started to occur a little bit to me. Mm. But you just think that, oh, this is just because you're in a band that plays indie rock music in a country of 26 million people. It was starting for me to get overwhelming about positing where this would lead. Do you know what I mean? Like it was more about we left because of I began to fear like what that would look like for my life in a lot of ways. Not just that was the only reason, but that was a big thing for me personally, a motivation. But it was a gratifying, it's gratifying if people like me. I enjoy that. I want to be liked by people. So people like my music, if my bandmates like me, do you know what I mean? Or if people just at least don't fucking totally despise me. Great, you know, and that was what the band, that was what, when Go Father and Lightness became like kind of a thing in Australia, that was really nice because it felt like, you know, it felt like all the lies I'd been telling myself about, you know, that I'm a worthless sack of shit, I'll never amount to anything, were just those, they were lies. It was gratifying in that sense, but all the stuff that came along with it was a bit tricky for me personally. What do you reckon, Maxie?
We have such different experiences. That's the weird thing. It's like you're in a band, you're in the same band. We've done that. We've literally run a business together basically for 10 years, like lived together
11
for
years,
tons of it, 11 years. But like, yeah, so I can, yeah, I don't really experience that shit, man. Like unless I'm literally on stage, I can watch like our support act if we're playing like an arena and no one will come up. Like, I'm literally like, I can have a beer. I get like ID'd by the fucking security guard. You know what I mean? Like, I wish that Dave could like switch out and like not have to deal with all that shit. But he, unfortunately, he's the sexy front man. So it's part of the gig.
Let's not blow too much smoke up me.
I'm just saying it's a funny, like, it's so hard. I almost can't weigh in. Like, I've watched it from a band perspective. I'm like, fuck yeah. Like, there's like 10,000 kids that I'm getting. Oh my God.
Like, it's honestly, I love this.
You know, that's all I think.
Yeah. It's not like this absurd level of invasiveness. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about for the kind of person I am. Like, I love people and I want to be around people and hug them and say thank you. It's just that too many, I feel like I'm disappointing everybody. Does that make sense? Because fucking Carrot Top could walk around. And I'm not using him as an easy target because like people like Carrot Top, but someone who he's not. Like super popular in Australia, he could walk past me in Australia and more people would be interested in Character. Do you know what I mean? Like that's the extent. But even that extent for me is difficult. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't really go well with the fucking, you know, the lovable loser bullshit thing that I've been promoting to everybody by the press in order to prey on people's sympathy so that I can get their money. It's not the whole lovable loser, beautiful loser fatalism as Robert Christgau would say about Bruce Springsteen. It's not that shit. It's just a genuine discomfort with what that looks like for me. I have a real hard time with it. I wish I was more like into it, you know, like you see fucking like football players here in the UK. Like I just saw a video of a particular player from a particular club saying "fuck this particular club," and I'm like, imagine having the confidence to say "fuck you" to your employer like that when they're paying you millions and millions a year. But and I just, I don't know, man. I don't have the confidence to be that, the self belief, I guess, to be like that version, to be that kind of person. Do you know what I mean, Max and Jordan?
Yeah, because there's different kinds of gigs, man. Like we're lucky that we also, you know, we still get to meet fans and shit in some places we play, you know, and so there'll be, you know, 500 kids in a club or something and you can kind of like go out and fucking have beer and it's not that weird, you know.
Max says kids like 18 year olds like our music and I'm not sure if they do. When Max says kids, like usually the people who come to our shows are like typically between the age of 25 to 60, and that
I don't mean
I think you're being overly generous to us because like the kids are they're not listening to our shit. I'm telling you, like I've been on TikTok exactly once, and they are not listening to our shit.
TikTok needs some serious work.
It needs the Marie Kondo treatment. Does this spark joy? No,
does this existing spark joy?
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia, starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you are able to meet with these fans, though, I mean, is there anything that you can hear from them that makes you think, you know, the days of sleeping on the couch and driving, you know, a couple hundred miles to play 15 people and all that was worth it? Is there one thing you can hear from those folks that really
just having those experiences, Jordan, fucking worth it? Being in a rock 100%. Band is being a rock band isn't doom and gloom like a representative. Like, it's just not. So much of it is just laughter and fucking joy and youthfulness and, you know, drinking and going to see different beautiful buildings across Europe. And like, so much of it is that. So when if someone comes to a show, I'm grateful. Do you understand? Like, I don't have to meet the motherfucker. Like, someone actually coming is important. Do you know what I mean? They've taken the time. They've done what I did as a kid, right? I listened to something, I loved it, and I went to go see it. Like, they've done what I did. You know, that for me is. Sorry, Max, keep talking over you, brother. But that for me,
it's
like I said, it's an indictment against all the bad stuff I told myself that I was, and it's confirmation that maybe my therapist and Max and the boys and my wife and my dad are probably right about me, that I'm not so bad. You know, it's confirmation of that fact. I like existing in that space. So when someone comes up and said, "Hey, great show, man, fucking great audience member, great job being an audience member," fucking, you know. And so it's so weird to be like, but I'm genuinely overwhelmed and filled with like love for anybody who wants to see us play. You know, even if they're just there to see Donnie, which I'm the same, you know. Or they're there because they're massive Noah and the Whale fans and they love Tommy, which I do also.
Oh, Tom Stands are my favorite thing, man. Like,
Tom Stands, mate. There's a whole fucking...
Oh, bro, there's a tribe.
There's a Tom Hobden adoration subcommittee meeting somewhere deep down. On Tumblr. No, but in the bowels of, like, the Pentagon, they've got a special fucking CIA constructed facility all dedicated to mining for pictures of fucking Tom when he was in Noah and the Whale. Gorgeous, gorgeous person. Love him.
Well, I could talk to you all day. I want to especially say again, this album is absolutely incredible, and it touched me deeply, and I thank you for that on a personal level. I guess my last question to you, and I've got three pages of questions, and I'm pulling one out of thin air right now that I'm making up on the spot. You invoked Bruce a moment ago. I was watching recently. I don't even remember what it was. He was doing some Q&A, some audience Q&A, and somebody stood up in the audience and said, "Yeah, Bruce, you know, I've been listening to you for years, and you've always been so generous with your lyrics and song meetings and just your emotions. You really seem to wear your heart on your sleeve. I feel like I know you. Do I?" And it was just such an amazing question. And I wish I could remember what Bruce said, but I guess I kind of wanted to put the same question to you both. With, you know, your music, you're so generous with everything that you do, everything that you put out there. Do we fans who know your music? Are we sort of allowed to feel like we know you in a way, or is that is there a division between you know, on stage and off stage?
To know Max is to love and adore Max, and anyone who doesn't love Max doesn't know Max. That's all I think about that. anyone stupid, delusional, mean, or narcissistic enough not to love Max, which is wild. Second, does that, Max? You answer that for me then.
I think Dave's an extremely you hate this word, but authentic person.
Convoluted person.
I think there's no obtuse. Fuck off, man. Obtuse. Like you're literally like a beautiful, like super compelling, wonderful human being. And I think so people see, yeah, I reckon if people see Dave perform and the way he tries to reach everybody. Dave sees everyone. Dave's the guy who like sees the dude in the corner of the room no one's talking to and talks to him. So I feel like if you get that from the gig, like you feel like you're connected to, then that, yeah, that's knowing Dave. And we're also pretty fucking, you know, basic bogan dudes. Like we're not, I feel like.
Well, Tom's not. With Tom, that, Tom and
Tom's
and
pretty. Yeah, but like if you were in the room with us, man, this would have just happened. If you were in the green room, the same conversation would happen. Like, there's no like, yeah. There's nothing performative, really. I don't think about. I mean, honestly, people probably wish there was more of it. Like, that's why we suck at social media, man, because we can't. I'm actually a real friend, you know. And Dave does something funny. I don't think, oh shit, I better get out the fucking TikTok, like. We just don't film each other. So, like, there's just nothing funny ever, you know? But we're actually really funny, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, we're actually really sort of interesting guys, but there's just no, desire to film it or whatever.
One of my biggest fears when it came to writing music was that people would look at me as I wasn't, you know? And I resent idol and hero worship. I resent people who look at people in my position like we're gods. We're fucking absolutely not. I find that repulsive, the idea that somehow I'd be treated any differently. And I think because of that, there's a sense of candor in the music, maybe. Like I've given it my own kind of brogue, the way I would phrase things, and maybe not in an Australian accent because I can't pull it off, but Courtney Barnett can. But yeah, my brogue's in there, like my thoughts, my feelings about shit. I don't like the state, so that's in there. It's a pretty big part of who I am. But I'm not one of them Gadsden flag types, or maybe I am. Who knows? It's America. You can be anything you want. I've been a dick. Sorry. A little bit of political humor there for you. I know how you Americans love politics. I think, man, this is just a good question, but do you know me? Like, I'd like to think so, you know, but you can't, if I guess if there's a real me who's more intolerable and irreverent than I am, even in this fucking context. So maybe if you get to know that person and you still like my music, then Jesus Christ, you deserve a fucking Nobel Peace Prize.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Kerry Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.